Hello, my name is Hallie Knipp. I'm here with Professor Mike Westall of the Computer Science Department, School of Computing. This is part of the Clemson University History of Computer Science Oral History Project. The date is July 19th, 2023. Dr. Westall, do I have permission to record you?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. So to get us started, can you kind of just give me a little bit of background info about yourself? Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? Things like that.
I grew up in Asheville, North Carolina. Went to the public school system there. Graduated from high school in 1964. Went to Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. Majored in math and physics. Graduated in 1968, was commissioned a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army Reserves. Went to graduate school at UNC Chapel Hill immediately thereafter, so I did not go to Vietnam. I finished a PhD in math in December 1972. Went to Signal Officer's Basic Course at Fort Gordon in spring of 1973. Along the way there, was at Fort Gordon for 4 months. It was a lot of fun. When along the way, I discovered that I was basically unemployable with a PhD in math. And so my advisor found me a job teaching in the evening college at night. And so for the academic year 1973-74, I did a quick run through the master's program in computer science. And during the first semester, I was taking 5 courses, teaching 3, but still had time to go to the bars at about 9 o'clock every night. So It was a fun year as well, even though I was very busy. And I did finish the master's in computer science, finished all the coursework that year. Interviewed at Clemson in February of 1974 with the Mathematical Sciences Department. And because they were trying to grow computer science, but they were still at heart a mathematics department, they liked the fact that I had the PhD in math and academic credentials in computer science, which then very few people had. And so I went from unemployable to having a nice job at a research university, which I've been here ever since.
Perfect. So did you come in teaching computer science courses?
Yes. I never taught what one would think of as a pure math course, even though during my years at UNC, 6 years total, modulo the Fort Gordon trip, I had taught all math as a teaching assistant. So I taught every year up there. Back then, at least at UNC, teaching assistants, even from the very get-go, were given full responsibility for a freshman class. They didn't teach labs or anything. They just taught the class just like any other faculty member was. So I was already very experienced at teaching math. And here I taught for a couple of years. I taught numerical analysis, which is basically math, but it's using computers to solve differential equations and systems of linear equations. So it's a senior level class that's a combination of math and computing. And so that was a natural fit for me. When we split off from math, math kept that course, so I never taught it again after the split.
Okay. So you kind of spoke on what attracted you to computer science, but what attracted you to math in the first place?
I don't know. I always liked it since I was in, going back to junior high school and all. And so I was in accelerated math courses from seventh grade on. And I remember when I was in 10th or 11th grade, we had to take some sort of aptitude test and then meet with a guidance counselor who was going to tell you what you ought to do with your life. And so the guidance counselor said, well, I see you like math and you're pretty good at it. I said, yeah, I like it. Have you ever considered being a bank teller? It was hard to resist bursting out laughing because, no, I had never considered being a bank teller. But when I went to grad school, mainly, A, because I didn't know what else to do with my life, and with an undergraduate degree in math and physics, there were no real demand for that in high-tech or low-tech or any tech world. And so math and physics was what I knew. And so I decided I liked math better than physics because math didn't have labs. And so I could play golf in the afternoons if I went to a math school. And then I applied to UNC, Georgia Tech, and Duke, and was admitted with an assistantship at all three places. So then I had the big decision of where will I go? And so I've always just kind of gone where the wind pushes me. And so here's how I made that decision. Well, I know some people at Duke, know people at Georgia Tech, but I've been to some jam up good parties and I know lots of people I can party with at UNC. So the decision is obvious, it will be UNC. And so that's how I ended up in math and at UNC. And then when I told my parents I was going to, they had funded my education at Davidson. Thank you, Mom and Dad. And when I told them I would be able to fund my own education henceforth with assistantships at UNC, they said, well, good, that's good. What do you plan to do with this PhD once you get it? And I said, well, I don't know. The only thing I'm sure about is I'm not going into teaching. So 50 years later, here you are in the professor's office.
I understand that. My family's a long line of teachers, and I always said I didn't want to go into education, and I'm pretty certain that's where I'm headed. So. Yeah. So you came in to Clemson's math department in 74, and in 78, the math option becomes its own department, the computer science option becomes its own department. Can you speak to that transition period a little bit?
Yeah, there were very few of us real computer scientists there. And I count myself one, even though my PhD was in math, because I did have a master's in computing. And so when I came, there was Jack Peck, who got his PhD at Southern Louisiana and came about 1970. And he was a tremendous go-getter and built an enterprise in information systems database development in the wing of the building next to the math, Martin Hall, next to the math department. And so he had gotten a lot of money and support from the state government. It was building systems for various aspects of the state government. And so that produced, that really helped grow the computing in the computer center part of the world, because the computer center was then run by a fellow that was had a master's degree and was in math and was a part of the math department. And so Jack then arranged to insert one of his buddies from USL, Russell Schwest, who became Russell West later on. And so Russell was brought in, and he would teach a course or two while running systems programming at the computer center. And then about the time I arrived, and they buddied up with Arnie Schwartz, who was the dean of the graduate school back then, and even Bob Edwards, who was president of the university. And so Jack and Arnie and Edwards made trips to Columbia together to lobby for more money for better computing facilities at Clemson, and so it would give them the ability to run the statewide online systems that Jack's group was developing out of the Clemson Computer Center. And then they kind of edged Merrill Palmer out the door, and Russell took over as director of the computer center. All of this was about the time I arrived. And so just that development of making the computer center a serious powerhouse of computing and an integral element of the state government's information systems at Clemson was kind of symbiotic with the development of computer science and the need or desire to split it off and let it become its own entity. And so that is an important aspect of what led to the split. And at the time before the split, there was a committee formed, and I'm not sure exactly how long the committee met, but maybe a year. And it had representatives from theoretically all of the competing groups or interested groups that came to computing. Basically, it was the computer science guys, which I think it was just me and Joe Turner, who came in 75 after I did, 1 year after I did, were on the computer science side of the committee. There's ECE then was already starting to fool around with CPM microcomputers. Those were just getting started back then. And so they had an interest in building microcomputers and programming them. And I think their representatives were, I know one of them was Mari Walla, and the other one I think was Tom Drake, but I'm not sure about that. And then the MAF also had their representatives, which I think were Robert Bob Heyman and Bob Bolin, who were in the numerical computing side of things, that they were more interested in applying computers to solving math problems than in computing on its own right. And so Bolin was also a Davidson graduate, about 5 years older than I was, and he was helpful in promoting my career. But Heyman was an older guy, And both of them, well, Bolin left pretty soon after computer science reform, not out of any stink. He went back into industry, went to Sandia Labs in New Mexico, which is a government lab and all kinds of high-tech nuclear other stuff. And so I think he just was tired of teaching and decided he didn't like academia and would rather work in a lab with a lot of smart guys, which Sandia was. And so we met for a while, and somehow we managed to convince ourselves that computer engineering and ECE and computer science could complement each other and not step on each other's turf. And so we didn't want to mess. We said we had no interest in taking over what you guys are doing. And they said, well, we have no interest in databases and the stuff you guys are doing. So that all went pretty well. Then, but the math people were a little less accepting, and they thought we were going to steal their students, and we did steal a lot of their undergraduate students, obviously, when the computer science program left the option, stole the option. But and I remember some strange. So comments that were outrageous, I'll leave them unacknowledged as to who made them. But at one point we were arguing about who would teach the introductory programming course, which was in Fortran programming. And I taught it a bunch of times since I'd gotten there. And so Turner and I argued that that was obviously something that ought to be part of computer science, the introductory programming. And one of the math guys said, well, how are we going to do our research if you take our first year programming course? So then we had a go around about that, you know, if your research is all about first year programming, I don't know what kind of research that is. But So that there were some, and then another time somebody said, we're talking about data structures, and I think ECE taught a data structures course in computer science was proposing one. One of the ECE's guys says, well, data structures for a microcomputer are a lot different than data structures for a mainframe. And the other ECE guy says, well, perhaps an ill-chosen example. And so it went along. But then at the end, the committee recommended in favor of computer science being as a separate department, no fighting between ECE, computer engineering, and computer science could do whatever they wanted, and nobody was going to try to tell the other one, no, this is my turf, you can't have it. And then with math and computer science won the introductory programming course, and we happily coughed up the numerical analysis course that I'd been teaching. And so math kept that, and I think they still have it. It was math sciences 409, 609, 410, 610 back then. Yeah.
So the issue of, you know, should computer science be part of, or not part of, but maybe working alongside computer engineering, has come up a couple times in these interviews, and people have different opinions about that. What is your view on, you know,
My view is it can work either way, and in some universities, computer engineering died because of computer science. At some, computer science died because of computer engineering, and at some, both pretty much flourished. And over the years, there's been, after it was the nervous first 10 years where everybody was finding their way and staking out their turf, we all got to know each other. And so we said, oh, we can do better by doing some things differently and jointly. And so we told them, okay, from now on, we're not going to teach computer architecture anymore. You guys have that. And they said, okay, we're not going to teach operating systems anymore. We think you can do it better than we do anyway. So you take operating systems. So our students took architecture over there. Their students took our operating systems over here. And so I think it has worked. It can work. And this is a good example of a place where it has worked fine. And we still, one of my research areas was computer networking, and I've served on a lot of graduate committees over there and worked jointly with some of the faculty over there. So we all seem to get along fine. And so from my perspective, it's all been very successful.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So obviously we're celebrating 45 years of a computer science department. A lot has happened since yes. then. Can you speak to the changes in the field and what you think have been the most significant changes in the field?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that the other night, and I was saying to myself that the changes in the computing field in the 50 years between 1970 and 2020 are just as significant as the changes in the transportation field between 1920 and 1970, which was also 50 years. And in 1920, we had cars, and we had some paved roads, and we had airplanes, but we didn't have airlines. And everybody rode a train everywhere. So there was just a massive revolution in transportation. And when I came here in 74, there was one mainframe computer on campus, and that was it. Maybe, I don't even think they had the microcomputers at all by then. I think they came out in the later 70s, but there may have been a precursor. But so everything has changed just totally radically. We still have a mainframe over there, but I don't know exactly what runs on it. It certainly, between 1974 and about 1990, all of our courses were taught using the IBM mainframe computer and logging in from terminals on campus. And then in the 30 years since 1990, the educational part morphed over to a combination. The computer center ran several digital equipment company, VAX computer, mini computers, which were really not so many back then. They were more powerful than the mainframe was in 1974. But, and then people were starting to get other, Unix was starting to sneak in back then. So the DEC ran their own mini computer operating system, and but Unix was the one that Bell Labs developed, and so most of our research work migrated to Unix and the Sun platform in the 1990s. The other huge revolutionary change, even after the advent of microcomputers, I bought an IBM, my first IBM PC in February 1982. They first shipped in 1981, and it had 640, no, it, when it came, it had 128K of memory, two 160K floppy drives, a serial port that you could attach to a modem that you could log into campus at 300 baud or 300 bits a second, which is 30 bytes a second roughly. Very slow speed networking, and there was no networking on campus at all, other than special purpose networking that connected terminals and remote job entry stations with printers and card readers back to the mainframe. But generic Ethernet was invented by Bob Metcalf in the 70s, and he went on to found 3Com Corporation, which still exists, although it's kind of faded in prominence over the years. And we finally had a campus Ethernet about that time. And so the motto of Sun, which is an acronym for actually Stanford University Network, because that's where the founders of Sun Microsystems came from, Stanford. And so they had a motto that says the network is the computer, and they were right. And so once you superimpose very fast for those days was 10 megabit networking, and you had all these computers working together connected by these fast links, that just changed the computing paradigm altogether. There was an interesting side effect to that I don't know if it was, I've speculated on this for years, if it was just a coincidence in time where there was something that caused it. And back in the 80s, we grew a pretty large undergraduate program, and close to half of the students were women. Mm-hmm. And right about the time the switch from the mainframe to mini computers, network computers, microcomputers happened, the women just disappeared. And so we would go from a class with, 35 students, maybe 20 men, 15 women, down to a class with 35 students, 32 men, and 3 women. It was literally that much of a change. And it changed. It wasn't just Clemson. It happened across the country. And there were various people, theories back then.
Yeah, I've read some papers that deal with that change, and it's so interesting that it happens like as computers are getting more powerful.
One theory was that the women didn't like to have to install their own systems and plug it in and hook up the network. They like just sit down at the terminal, talk to the mainframe. It always works. It works the same way. If it doesn't work, it's not my job to worry about what went wrong. And so sometimes the mainframe didn't work. I don't know. Then there's another theory that was the same era as the Revenge of the Nerds movies. Mm-hmm. And that so it became kind of the theory that the typical computer guy were these awful nerdy people. And so women would say, "You, why would I want to go into a job where all the men look and act like that?" And so, but as far as I know, nobody ever came up with a definitive answer. And it's still not fully balanced again. I mean, yeah, which is amazing because even in the 90s, certainly in the 80s, Clemson was well over 60% men and under 40% women. And in most undergraduate universities now, most state universities, USC, UNC, are now close to 60% women and 40% men. But their computer science programs are still largely men. So there was a lot going on everything changed over those years, from the network computers, the standalone mainframe, to the network computers, and the technology, obviously, when in the 70s, my first project, which was deemed my research project at Clemson, was to build a high performance text editor for the mainframe, which allowed people to type in programs and other stuff on the terminal, and then the editor is what you enter, is the program you interacted with that allowed to display your information, allowed you to change it and whatever. And so back then, at one point, we had a mainframe that probably had maybe a 6 megahertz processor. And now all processors are at least 3 gigahertz. So that's 500 times faster per processor. And a computer like this has 8 3 gigahertz processors. And so the memory was like 4 megabytes, and now 4 gigabytes is small. So it's just, when you think about it that way, it's mind-boggling, the changes. So 1,000 times more memory and 5,000 times more processing power in one of these than was in our mainframe in 1974 that serviced the whole campus. And so we did build a high performance editor and file system for archiving the data and letting you go back and get it later. And that allowed us to service 300 simultaneous users on this mainframe, one mainframe that's a thousandth of the power of that computer. It's it's probably even more awesome than a World War One Curtis Jenny versus a Boeing 747 in the transportation building. It's just, nobody can really grasp the difference, a factor of 1,000, but here we are, and so we lived through all that.
Yeah, I've been working on this project for a few months now, and I don't know that I had conceptualized like the power of the mainframe at that time versus, you know, what we have in my, like, in my backpack now.
Yeah.
That's, thank you for putting that into perspective. I don't know that I had, like, fully visualized that.
Yeah.
So at what point, not at what point, what do you, how does the internet and the World Wide Web change things on campus? And how does it affect the department?
The internet changed everything. By that I mean Ethernet is the physical connectivity, but the internet is the protocols that make it usable. Mm-hmm. And so Ethernet without the internet is just a wire that you can't, it's not useful for anything. So the internet itself came to be and probably, you know, it was, Clemson was late to the party on the internet, so that the internet was around in the 1980s and on like all of the high tech campuses. So any place like MIT or Stanford had high speed networks connecting their campus computers. But the web did not really emerge as a major user of the internet until close to 2000. So the internet was 15 years of, and so people just used it and they figured out different ways to use it better and more efficiently. And so the internet basically replaced a dial-up network for off-campus and remote use where people were just using telephone links. Then the internet made it possible to use the internet protocols can run over a telephone link for that matter. So they're independent of the technology underlying them, but the internet generally meaning internet protocols over high-speed networks. And so that all sorted itself out in the 80s. In the middle 80s, there were three major competing network technologies, and it was not clear who was going to win. So one was the internet. One was the ISO OSI, International Standards Organization, Open Systems Interconnection Protocol Stack. And the other was IBM Systems Network Architecture, which was similar to ISO OSI. And some people said that each one of them stole from the other. But IBM was obviously, they were pushing it for networking IBM mainframes. An interesting aspect is that that IBM mainframes were really not networkable until about 1990. So they just, I mean, you could connect them and have some specific, but connection protocols where you had like a file transfer program, but no general networking stack between them, but IBM SNA, so it started out as a hybrid, a hierarchical network model with the mainframe at the top and terminals and RJEs and mini computers like the System 32 and the System 34, the System 38 out there. And then finally they managed to add a hunk to it, which was a link between two mainframes. And that made a real network. And when they turned SNA into a real network, they called it MSNF, which is for Multi-Systems Networking Facility. And everybody laughed about that because everybody that knew about networking said, well, of course, networking has always been about multi-systems. This is not a great breakthrough to figure out in 1990 that you can network two mainframes together. But at any rate, they, and particularly in the business world, IBM networking was very widely used. And in Europe, ISO-SI was very widely used. And I remember we had a lot of work with research work with DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, in the 80s involving networking. And somehow I remember getting my hands on a DARPA publication that, and of course, DARPA was the original sponsor of the internet. But even in 1988, DARPA had a document out that said DARPA plans for migration from internet protocols to ISO-OSI. So nothing in the 80s, it was not clear who was going to win. And then in the 90s, it finally sorted itself out. And it was clear that the internet had won, and it had won for, if I can get on my networking professor hat, for an obvious reason, that ISO and IBM protocols were connection oriented. So that meant that every layer of the protocol, router to router, network stack to network, had a connection with its peer at the other end. And what that meant was all these lower level protocols had to be very complex because they had to be able to wise enough to support connection protocol, disconnection protocol, loss of connection. But the ARPANET protocols were connectionless until you got all the way up to the host end to other host end layer. So TCP was a connection oriented host-to-host protocol running above connection-less IP protocol and Ethernet protocol. And so it's a whole lot easier for different vendors to implement connection-less protocols that will interoperate together successfully than to try to make everybody agree on all the details of the connections. And so that's and then as the internet grew, obviously there were hundreds of vendors, thousands of vendors of adapter boards where the Ethernet protocol lived, and hundreds of vendors of routers. And so it was just infeasible to try to think that all of them could get a complex connection-oriented lower level protocol to work, and they couldn't, but they all could get IP and Ethernet to work adequately. So that was why, in my view, that it was inevitable that going back to, with 2020 hindsight, back to the late 70s when the ARPANET was invented, that you could see that it was going to win in the long run. But even in the 90s, it wasn't. So back to the web. The web was, oh, you probably can remember his name. I can remember the names from the 70s better than the 90s. But there was a Swiss guy that basically invented the web. And so, but by then, email was already booming, and file transfer was booming, and these Usenet was a distributed group of Unix users, and they built this thing called the news feed, and everybody read the Usenet news, and so they had different categories, and so it's kind of like comments you read on a web page. Everybody could post their ideas by what the topic was, and then a lot of people, so pretty much everything except streaming media that the web did, it was already being done. But the main difference was that the web slapped kind of a modern graphical interface on it and theoretically made it easier for users to use. And also, obviously, the streaming media aspect of it, where you could watch a video inside a web page, was something that hadn't been done before. And so from, say, the year 2000, when the web existed, but was probably less than 5% of internet traffic. Nowadays, I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but the last time I looked, it was like 90 to 95% of every byte carried on the internet is web traffic. So it's basically everything now.
So obviously that's a lot of changes in roughly a 15-year period between mid-80s to the early 2000s. How does that affect the teaching in the department, or does it?
It honestly, the basic principles of computer science haven't changed.
Right.
So the key concepts in data structures, operating systems, mainly in operating systems, the main problem to get the students to get their arms around is cooperating processes, mutual exclusion, the need for mutual exclusion because of race conditions, where two processes that are running simultaneously on a multiprocessor computer and accessing the same data can destructively mess up each other unless there is a mutual exclusion mechanism that says, I want to put a lock on this data because I'm going to update it. And then the other process hits the lock and says, oh, I'm locked. And so it's automatically blocked until the next process releases the lock. And incompetent locking programs can produce deadlock, where both processes get infinitely blocked until one of them is terminated. So all of that stuff is really independent of the platform. And so we would change our examples and obviously couch the discussion in the terms of the current system, but in the real computer science curriculum, there was not a lot of changes to the curriculum, because the principles really don't change.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you mentioned Fortran, and like looking at the early course catalog descriptions, it looks like Fortran and COBOL and PL1 are really emphasized. But as we go forward, there's a ton added to the curriculum almost every year in terms of programming languages.
Yeah, I have mixed emotions about that. I was taught one language, Fortran, but I know a dozen, and I'm probably not still fluent in all of them because it's been so long. So I I'm of the school that says computer science is not teaching programming language. It's not learn to code. You can learn, to me, learn to code is telling somebody, here's pseudocode for an algorithm I want to run on this computer. I want you to translate this pseudocode into Modulo 2 or Pascal or Ada or COBOL or whatever. That's learning to code. That's not learning to develop complicated algorithms. So complicated algorithms, a good example of the two hardest are cooperating processes, where you have multiple processes working together to solve a single problem, and damn near impossible to debug, trust me. And the other are things that, algorithms that involve graph searching and commonly recursion, that you can be an ace coder and know how to write every line of C or whatever that's ever been written, and somebody tell you to write a program that will give you this map of nodes here that are connected by some lines, and we'll name the nodes, and we want you to write a program that will figure out the fastest path from here to here that visits every node. And somebody that has learned to code will be clueless. And so that's, this problem and others is what data structures is all about. It's learning to solve learning to solve, transform a conceptual problem into a real algorithm that solves it. And so that's, again, that's something that's totally independent of the programming language or the programming platform that you happen to be using. And so that's the difference between real computer science and learning to code. And my colleague Robert Geist and I were great friends for, still are for that matter, but worked together closely for about 40 years. And we were of one mind on, you need to construct knowledge from the ground up. So start simple and then build on it. Don't try to start simple and branch out. So we believed that what you, and we had an NSF grant in the 2000s to implement this theory in our courses, that start with a simple language and just stick with it, and people will learn to solve problems a lot quicker than if you, every semester you say, well, we're gonna start with a new language now. And back then in the 70s, there were people that claimed some languages you could solve, were easier or better or whatever, solving problems. But Geist and I always thought that the language that helps the student understand the mapping the problem to the solution, which is the computer, is the language that's closest to the computer. And the absolute closest to the computer is assembly language, because there's a one-to-one correspondence between programming instructions and machine instructions. But, and in fact, that text editor and file system I wrote in the 70s was 100% written in assembly language. And I still look at it, the code, sometimes today, and marvel at it today. Why would anybody do this in assembly? Because in the modern world, the C language